You are listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, episode 19, summarizing security news and items of interest for the week ending the 7th of October 2016. So let's get started. I'm Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong.
And I'm Brendan from the ABSH Group in Melbourne, Australia.
If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favorite podcast app. Well, another interesting week of reports and news and various bits and pieces, so I think we have a good podcast coming up.
Indeed, and I'm quite happy to report no new DDoS world records this week.
I'm sure that'll come.
I reckon they're just waiting for the right time to launch the next... We haven't had a terabyte attack yet, have we?
No, we haven't.
960, wasn't it, I think, the largest?
Yeah, I'm sure with the U.S. presidential election coming up, there'll be ample opportunity.
Oh, yes. Anyway, moving straight into it, vulnerabilities for the week.
Yes, so we have a, I guess we can start with the Android lock screen issues. Perhaps you would like to educate us on that one, Brendan.
Yes, it was quite an interesting piece of malware. Very similar to, I guess, ransomware, but for your phone. It basically ran an app and prompted the user to enter a PIN number in order to return access to their device. Initial versions of the malware used a hard-coded PIN, so it was very easy for security researchers to work out what it was and people to unlock their phone. The other interesting part was you could actually boot the Android device into safe mode and root it and then remove that particular application, which was causing the PIN number to come up. But they recently modified the code and obviously upgraded it to use a random number generator. So the number is no longer hard-coded, making it a lot more difficult to unlock the device. And then one strain actually went a little bit further than that and changed your actual PIN number. So it actually installed the malware, rooted the phone, installed the app, locked it, and then also changed your PIN on your phone so that you couldn't change it in safe mode nor unlock it using reverse engineering tactics. So I guess, and initially, not very nasty, but certainly getting...
Obviously evolving... As obviously security researchers and people figure out ways to get around it, which is how obviously a few of these things have evolved over time. There are ransomwares that have done the same thing. They've plugged holes in their systems as time has gone on.
I was just going to say, I wonder whether this is the start of the local desktop and laptop security has evolved, and you know, we're doing a lot better now at mitigating those threats. So, you know, cybercrime rings have moved on to the next path of least resistance, which is your mobile devices, because they don't have any. Well, sorry, a lot don't have any security products installed most of the time.
Yeah, and in some cases, like on Apple, there's not a lot any security device can do anyway because the platform's locked down pretty hard. With something like Windows, your anti-malware programs dig deeply into the way the operating system works in order to sort of, try to prevent things from happening. And I suspect with some of the mobile operating systems, there is probably at this point a lot less that they can do, and perhaps that will evolve over time as they get more technically proficient doing products for these as well. And one of the interesting thing points for me on this one was saying you could reach your phone if you boot into safe mode, but rooting your phone on some devices, let's say you got that on a device with Samsung locks, for example, or BlackBerry, can actually make the secure part of the phone actually non-operational. So it's possibly not recommended to do that in the first place. If you actually have anything secure on your phone, you're better off perhaps wiping it.
Also, I think it's another reason why the lock screen malware only targets Android. One, I think because of the fundamental differences of how other products, especially Apple, have designed their operating system. But I think the second part is because, like we've discussed many podcasts in the past, the Android is a combination. It's an operating system that's then provided to a number of manufacturers, and often those manufacturers don't provide a mechanism for you to update that platform. Okay. And so there is a huge number of devices that are running previous versions of Android, which are vulnerable to a number of exploits, which allow them to root the phone and put the malware on. And again, going back to that, what's the path of least resistance with a big user group? It is this definitely Android and very, very simple way to, I guess, make some money. People love their phones. They're almost, I'd say, more important in some respects than people's local computers and things, because, you know, most of the time photos of loved ones and things are actually on our mobile devices and very rarely backed up or ever transferred to our desktops and laptops.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to figure out how they've monetized this, because you have to get a code back for that, which would mean that it would need to communicate with some server, I would have thought.
So that's
why they...
Yeah, I think that's semantics.
That's why they would have had to move off from a hard-coded one, which obviously they can obviously provide you, but if it's a random number-generated one, then they have to pass that back to whatever system is actually going to be taking money from you.
I believe, and we'd probably need to do a little bit more digging to confirm it, but I believe they're using the same distribution model as the ransomware.
Ransomware, yeah, I think they're
using the exact same wholesaler, same. For want of a better term.
Yeah. could well be. Anyway, same, obviously, very much similar vein of recommendations to dealing with malware on computers in some ways. You know, obviously, back up your back up your phone. It's obviously a key component on this. Very, very careful about what apps that you do install. I mean, we've talked about a couple of weeks ago, one particular group had 400 applications on the Google Play Store that were actually malware. So be very selective about what you put on your phone. Obviously, just getting the latest, cheap kit or, lock screen picture, all those kinds of things may not be advisable. Treat this now as you would a computer, and be a little bit careful about what you put on. Obviously, stay away from third-party app stores, and as I've already discussed, obviously don't root your phone. It's generally not recommended.
Yeah, because then obviously you expose yourself to third-party app stores when you root it, right? And just, I think the big one is, right, like you said at the start, back up your phone. And there's so many apps now that make it so very easy for you to back up the most important data. You know, for most people, their phone, certainly the clients that we've seen that have either dropped it or broken it or locked it out or whatever, the number one complaint is, I've lost all my photos. And, whether that's a pet or someone that's passed away, or a baby that was just born, or some trip that was a lifetime or a wedding, and it makes it so easy now with so many apps to just have them uploaded and synced to the cloud.
And if you're lazy, just go with the basics. I mean, Apple and Google have services that are obviously on both Apple and Android phones, but there's a lot of third-party ones too. I mean, for example, if you're in the Microsoft space, you have, say, an Office 365 account. You can put OneDrive on there, and that can be configured to back up stuff as well. So there's lots of different ways of doing it. Dropbox can do the same thing. So there are lots of options, and there are obviously a lot of reputable cloud backup services.
Mm. Definitely make sure you stick to a reputable one, right?
Yep, definitely.
Other interesting vulnerabilities for the week?
Yeah, well, I guess it's more of a follow-up. We had discussed the issues that WoSign was having with cryptographic certificates on the 2nd of September podcast that we did. This is a Chinese certificate authority, and we're having trouble due to sort of breaking some of the rules. There was moves within Firefox, for example, to potentially block them, although they have a very lengthy and democratic process for going about that. what they had done was allow people to continue issuing untrusted certificates well past when the agreed date to stop issuing those was. And so they were breaking the rules around that the sort of certificate authorities had agreed to. Firefox, or I should say Mozilla Org, which is the organization behind Firefox, is still currently discussing this. However, Apple have come out and just basically said that they will stop supporting any new certificates that WoSign creates, which effectively means that WoSign will not work on Apple devices going forward and potentially basically destroys, breaks the business. So, you know, I guess there's a lesson here. You know, certainly when there are rules around things, you know, it can be detrimental to be a little bit greedy and try to accommodate people that don't want to do what the rules say. So, you know, in this case, this is potentially a business-ending decision on their part.
Yeah, I think it's important too for the listeners that are, you know, semi-technical or not so technically savvy. You know, the whole internet, anytime you see that little padlock on your website that you're browsing, or go to a HTTPS web link, you know, that security that you're reliant on, that you're believing in, that, you know, the data transmitted between that website and your device is encrypted, you know, that relies on a certificate provider. And there's a number of certificate providers around the world, but they're very much like a passport issuer, right? You can get a passport from multiple countries, but if you've got one country that's a little bit relaxed on how they issue the passports, they become a lot easier for you to fake, and then the whole system falls down.
Well, people stop trusting those passports, which is exactly what's happening in this case. So the browsers are obviously a corner. One of the other cornerstones of the internet have decided that they can no longer trust these security passports, essentially. Mm. And so, you know, this passport authority, or this certificate authority, to put it another way, is going to have trouble issuing these going forward. You know, which basically means that anyone that has is relying on them is advised to look elsewhere.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. You're going to have to get some new certificates with new certificate providers and get them replaced on all your various services, whether that's web servers or Active Directory controllers or whatever you're using them for.
And it's possibly still likely that Firefox and perhaps Google, and I haven't heard anything from Google yet, so will go ahead at some point and also block them.
Mm. Yeah, very much so.
And that's it for that. I don't think we need to spend any more time on that one. Our next one, I guess, goes back to our massive denial of service attack in weeks gone past, but a bit of other news around that.
We also spoke about this on our podcast last week, so I guess another follow-up.
Indeed. You want to take the lead on this one?
Sure. So we had... that was the botnet that took down the security research journalist Krebsen, and also a French ISP. The first botnet was clocked at 600 odd gigabits per second, the one that took down Krebsen Security's website, and the French ISP copped a whopping 990, so almost 1 terabyte a second. That was gigabits per second, wasn't it? So yeah. Certainly the largest attack in history, and it was 2 weeks in a row where we saw the DDoS world record beaten, and certainly almost close to double. But the interesting news this week, following up from that event, was the source code for the malware that was behind the infection of all the various devices that participate in this botnet. The source code was released. It was analyzed by obviously multiple security professionals, and it was found to be quite simple. It was literally just a telnet scanner. So it's basically just a little piece of software that goes out and scans the internet for IP addresses that have open ports, and then tries to make connections on those ports with hard-coded credentials, and it had 36 of them, and they were just basically the default username and passwords for your, you know, your home-based router or your CCTV camera, locks for your doors, or any basic Internet of Things device. And so the commentary from the security industry around this has been, this is a massive botnet. You know, to be able to take down an ISP requires a huge amount of bandwidth, and it's being done by utilizing some very, very basic devices and just being able to compromise them. And largely that has happened because the manufacturers of those devices use the same username and password for them. They're, you know, admin, admin, admin password, admin, no password, for example. And there's been some industry-wide calls to kind of say, hey, you know, we really need to stop this. We need to give them custom passwords, or we need to force, you know, on setup the user changes the password. But obviously, and this comes back, I guess, also to, you know, conversations we've had in the past where a lot of the times those devices are aimed at consumers. Therefore, simplicity of configuration is crucial because they want the user to have a good experience. They just want to be able to plug it in and work. And most, you know, consumers aren't getting technical people to install them, and they're not technically savvy themselves. Therefore, they, you know, don't know, I guess, that they should go in and disable certain things or change the passwords. And therefore, it leads to this situation we're in right now, where you've got a huge amount of devices which are insecure, which are on the internet, and unfortunately have standard username and passwords, which make them vulnerable to hackers hijacking them to put them into their little botnet and use them to attack legitimate organizations.
Yeah, and there's a couple of other points around that too. You know, one of them is often, you know, when there is sort of a you know, you see this over the years where there's a boom around a specific device. You know, you could look at, for example, a couple of years ago, you know, this is not necessarily internet-related things, but, you know, the latest Christmas fad, for example, might be some kind of drone or whatever else. And you get similar things around some of these internet-connected devices, saying like a baby monitor, you know, so, you know, you can watch your baby from home when you're at work, or, you know, when you have a babysitter around, or those kinds of things.
That's a massive one here in Australia, the baby monitor, and followed by the internet monitor.
You know, and the issue around these is because it becomes so popular, there is a rush from the manufacturers. And you know, I don't mean necessarily big brands here, but it can be them also. But certainly a lot of the small, cheaper ones, you know, you go down to your cheap shop or whatever you buy your local electronics from, and I can't tell you what that is in Australia anymore. But, you know, you go and you buy the, you know, the cheap baby monitor, and it'll be a no-name brand on the side there. And they rush to get these out, literally, where they can turn around a product design within weeks or months, get it manufactured, get it shipped out to suppliers that are demanding that. You know, the last thing they care about is how secure it is. You know, it really is a rush to market. You know, it's you know, in some cases it's surprising how the thing works sometimes when you get it out of the box. So, you know, the security on it is obviously one of the last things that's considered there. And so, and that is very much a consumer driven thing. You know, the cheapness here, I know there's one here at, say, you know, $14.95, and there's another one here at $19.95. They claim they do the same thing. Which one are you going to buy? So, you know, there is sort of certainly some blame on consumer and the consumer society that we have at the moment on this. The other thing to bear in mind on this, of course, is that often when these things are plugged in, they stay plugged in for years. You know, there's some of these devices, this 152K of cameras and CCTVs and baby monitors and whatever else is that made up this botnet. Some of those will stay connected in someone's home or in their garage or whatever else, or in an office, you know, a Soho office somewhere. And that will stay there until it dies.
I got a funny story on that, right? So I did an audit for a client, and it's a 2-minute story. I went out there, and the client was complaining about their performance and their internet and various other things. But one of the things we established in the audit was there was actually 2 D-Link wireless cameras behind one of the desks, literally on the floor. They'd fallen off the desks and they were just sitting there. looking at nothing, just looking at the ground. But they were on the wireless network. They were fully powered up, plugged in. Username and passwords were the complete default. So you are spot on. When I asked the client, I said, what are these used for? He's like, I don't even know. I think they were here when we moved in. We just put the desks over the top.
And that's exactly what happens. So these things will remain part of this botnet. Unless the botnet itself is taken down, these things will remain. And maybe, you know, there might even be fights from the, you know, from the dark web over who owns the particular devices. You know, there'll be people that go in and knock off the other malware, right?
Yep.
And these things will be part of this infrastructure, this sort of dark web botnet infrastructure, until the point of where they literally die or the power gets turned off in whatever house or unit or office that they're in. And you know, this is a major issue, and there's major long-term implications to this sort of rush to market and the sort of the cheapness around some of these things.
Mm-hmm. We almost need a global legislation around manufacturing process for technology products. It would never happen, but that's what you would kind of need, I guess, to kind of stem this issue, because the other, I guess, side note to that also is, not only do the manufacturers want that product to be very easy to use, they also obviously want to minimize, because the price point of the product, they want to minimize support calls, right?
There is no support, right? There will, you know, in a lot of cases, there are no updates for these things. You know, the firmware is burned onto it. There is no update mechanism, let alone no automatic update mechanism. You know, even if as a consumer, you probably can't update the firmware. Even if you could actually, you know, change it and recode it yourself.
Mm-hmm. So, recommendations?
Don't go too cheap, I guess. obviously that's going to fall on deaf ears, but you know, if you are responsible for setting up any of these sorts of devices, you know, very much change the default username and password. Write it down somewhere, stick it on a password manager or secure note system, or even just in your email yourself or something, so you can go back and find it later on. One of the issues with some of these things is that they do use something called universal plug and play, which enables them to actually change the firewall by themselves without a user, and open up ports and that allows the internet to get through to them. Obviously, you may not want that if this is not designed to be a public device that you want everybody watching you on. So that would be the main two things I have, and then obviously secure your Wi-Fi.
Still there, Stuart? So it's time for my favorite part of the podcast, reports for the week.
Yep, and I guess we can start with some Yahoo follow-up.
Yeah, so again, something we spoke about last week, although last week we did talk about the Yahoo data breach, but Yahoo back in the news again this week with a report from Reuters.
Indeed, so... Sorry, just taking a swig of coffee there. There was a report that Yahoo, there was the claim that Yahoo insecurely backdoored its email system for either the NSA or FBI. And obviously this has caused a bit of a brouhaha or a stink or whatever you want to call it these days. Supposedly, they've allowed American intelligence workers to scan all incoming Yahoo mail for keywords. And in fact, I've even heard it suggest that it included historical email as well. And in this particular case, made no attempt to challenge the demand. The backdoor was apparently so insecure that opportunistic hackers could have plundered it for messaging. And in fact, one of the interesting things around this was one of the major flare-up points between Yahoo's former head of security, Alex Stamos, they had with Marissa Meyer, who's the CEO of Yahoo. And in fact, at one point, it is believed that when the security team actually came across this and believed that Yahoo had been hacked, when they brought this up, were told, no, that's actually a deliberate. And in fact, so there was actually quite a stink between the Yahoo security team and the engineering team that had put this in place on the behest of obviously senior officials within Yahoo. And in fact, it is suggested that this was one of the key reasons that Stamos quit and then ultimately went on to become head of Facebook security. One of the interesting, obviously, follow-up points is that Yahoo released a carefully worded statement that didn't deny but didn't quite acknowledge it either. So the statement does state that the messaging filtering system does not exist. However, it didn't confirm if the ability did exist and doesn't now, never existed in the first place, or whether something else exists or existed in the past. So they were very, very careful in their wording around the statement. And of course, this just goes on to add to Yahoo's woes at the moment. Anything you'd want to add to there, Brendan?
Just I found some of the interesting commentary we've had throughout the week from various security professionals. So obviously we had James Clapper, who is the director of the National Intelligence Agency, explain a very interesting abstract version of how they interpret various terms. So when asked whether they were collecting data, they said no, because to the NSA, collecting data means both collecting and analyzing. Mass gathering of data is actually not interpreted as collecting. Very stark contrast to the positions taken from, you know, your other leading tech firms like your Googles, Facebooks, Apple, and so forth. And the other one that I heard during the week was at the Cambridge Cybersecurity Summit. There was NSA Admiral Michael Rogers speaking about the actual Yahoo article that was reported by Reuters. And he said that the article's speculative and, you know, cited that getting blanket access to all emails would be illegal under the current US law. And then further went on to say that, you know, for a request to be granted, basically, they'd have to make a specific cast. So, you know, specifically, what are they looking for? And then give them a specific period of time that they would like to search for that information and the reason why. Now, there's, I guess, a little conjecture around, you know.
Yeah, some of it's speculative, obviously. I remember an incident a few years ago. There was the I can't remember off the top of my head. There was that email provider LavaBit or something like that that Edward Snowden had used to communicate with, and the owner of that had actually shut down the service because he was given a order from authorities in the United States that he had to give them the entire encryption for basically the SSL root certificate for all of that, so that they could basically look at all incoming and outgoing email at any time. So this kind of flies in the face of some of this in some regards. I mean, obviously, you know, this is getting a little political on areas that don't directly impact people either here in Hong Kong or in Australia. Obviously, what the US does is important globally, but you know, this is... Yeah, but obviously what the US does has an impact globally, but there are specific things that are only sort of domestic to them in some ways as well. So I guess moving on, anything, unless there's something else you want to add there,
Brendan? Just some recommendations, I guess. You know, if there's certainly been a number of... reports out there suggesting that if you haven't changed your email provider, then it may be time to switch from Yahoo. Although I'm guessing that's not going to be great for Yahoo in terms of their sale to Verizon. The other obvious one would be if you haven't already changed your Yahoo password. That would be something I would get onto immediately. Any other recommendations you can think of, Stuart?
Yeah, I guess just one thing there. I mean, anybody that's been on the internet for a while probably has a Yahoo account. You know, obviously Yahoo was one of the first providers of free email services on the internet. And it can be interesting if you still do have a Yahoo account and you still have access to it to go in and have a look at some of the historical stuff there. There may be information there that I guess provides background or details, you know, into you. So if you are looking at, you know, moving on per se, you may also want to look at purging your account before you do so. I don't believe Yahoo has a way to just simply delete your account, but you may want to look at going in and deleting all of the historical stuff, particularly if you aren't or you know, aren't using it anymore. And have no intention to. And the other thing, of course, is that in some cases, you know, a Yahoo account may have been used to set up password resetting or various services that you've used in the past. And it is one important note to have a look at those, and maybe time to change those as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, running short on time, so do we want to quickly cover off just the latest report from PwC?
Yes, let's do that one quickly.
So that was the 2017 Global State of Information Security Survey, which was done by PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers. Shows a rise in security spending and privacy and security awareness training, which is great news for both the security industry, I guess, but also for you know, business and their defense against cyber threats. The survey looked at 10,000 businesses and IT executives and queried the current and future plans for protecting their digital assets and the rising security risks. Well, I won't go through in detail, but just to summarize the key takeaways, which were really interesting. The first was an overall change in attitude towards technology. And what they mean by that is initially organizations saw technology as a threat and the whole cyber defense as just a massive cost center. But the reports found that they're actually now adopting technology to manage that threat, and not only managing the threat, but also achieving a competitive advantage. So, you know, they're saying that some organizations are using cybersecurity solutions to facilitate their business growth and build brand trust. And a key example of that is probably, like we were just discussing, you know, Yahoo
versus Google.
That's probably lost some brand trust, and Google's certainly standing up for privacy has certainly earned some. So that was really interesting. The other key takeaways, I guess, were the fact that businesses are gaining trust in the cloud. You know, it's no longer just used for dev workloads. They're also seeing a lot of production workloads move in there, and not just you know, IT functions or customer service, but also some financial and operational functions have been moved. So they were saying that 63% now have moved IT functions to the cloud, 34% have moved customer service to the cloud, and 33% have started to move their financial and operational functions to the cloud providers. So that was quite interesting, and I guess confirms that, you know, the fact that the march to the cloud is certainly well on its way. The other one was just some stats around security. You know, they're saying that 57% of businesses are now using biometrics to improve trust among customers and business partners. 62% are using a managed security service provider. And largely the response to that question was because there is a real lack of cybersecurity talent out there in the marketplace. So where you can't build your own team, obviously it makes sense to leverage someone else's. And that's certainly what's happening right now. And then the last one was more than half, 53%, were using open source software within their cyber defense strategies. So That was quite interesting. You know, they're not using the mainstream products. They're relying on some open source, obviously, you know, with plenty of customization. But that was certainly very interesting. And they also stated that of the 53% that are using open source, 49% found that had a positive impact on their cybersecurity posture. So a great read if you've got the time to go and have a look at it, although we did just summarize the points there. And the last one was just on cybersecurity spending, which was 59% have said that they're increasing their cybersecurity spending as a result of digitizing their business. So I guess another takeaway was that, you know, businesses are not just moving to the cloud, but also looking at ways that they can integrate technology into their organization. And as they move adopt those technology, you know, a lot of their data is obviously moving to the cloud, which exposes them to risk. And hence, they're needing to counter that with some additional cybersecurity spending to make sure that, you know, they defend it and protect it and do everything they can, I guess, to ensure that the client's data is safe. So very, very interesting report overall.
Yeah, I certainly found it interesting as well, and I think you've summarized all the key points there. Well, certainly, obviously, the march to the cloud is on, but obviously, you know, businesses are seeing cybersecurity and you know, as something that you know, differentiates them in some ways. As you said, the sort of Yahoo versus Google, or, you know, the other side of that, of course, is, you know, people like Apple, for example, you know, taking on, you know, privacy and privacy of clients as being a key thing, and the security around their products as being a key market differentiator as well. And obviously there are a number of others sort of in that space that, you know, where they are, you know, standing up for, trying to protect consumers or protect businesses and so on, and just seeing that as a key point.
Yeah, definitely.
Do we? All right. We have lots of stuff here to talk about, but I guess quickly, I just thought this one was interesting, which was the selfie pay.
I love that.
Maybe spend 2 minutes on this before we wrap up for today.
Yeah, just the I guess the lighter side, although it is still serious, but MasterCard will be officially rolling out selfie pay in Europe next year after successful trials in the US, Canada, and the Netherlands. Basically, selfie pay is you use a selfie of yourself to log into your MasterCard app to authenticate your purchases. So instead of getting a one-time code or using two-factor authentication, you basically just snap a photo, and if the app confirms that using facial recognition that's you, then yep, they will certainly process that payment for you. And I guess there are a number of concerns around it, but it's an interesting way to use technology, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these things, obviously, you know, all of these, you know, the banking and the finance industry in general is obviously around risk management, you know, and I guess one of the things that has been a real problem for you know, not just financial institutions, but you know, online systems in general is people having to remember passwords, and when they, you know, using stupid passwords or bad passwords in place of something secure, and perhaps, you know, this is seen, you know, while it is kind of, you know, they require you to blink, but, you know, like I said, personally to you, Brendan, you know, I wonder how long before someone just has a Photoshop app of someone blinking, for example.
Animated GIF or
something like that. Maybe this will actually provide better risk management than the current password and 2FA system. So it's certainly an interesting move. I don't know that I plan on being an early adopter of this.
But then again, you probably have a strong password, so it's probably...
But it's certainly, you know, watch this by... So it'll be interesting to see what happens with this, because I'm sure there will be security researchers that try to pull this apart as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. And no doubt we'll have a follow-up in early next year as they start to go live with it and we start getting reports on what happens with it and how accurate it is. Yeah, that's the other thing, right? I mean, you take a selfie with makeup and you take a selfie with no makeup. Is it going to be able to tell the difference? What about after you run and you're all sweaty, or after you've gone for a swim, or you've got sunburn?
You have hair falling over your face, or you've got a hat on. Or...
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, we could have a lot of fun with it. But I think we're well and truly over time as we have been for the last few episodes. So we do apologize, but we hope you're getting a lot of value out of it.
And I guess I will wrap up with don't reuse your passwords.
Until all right. Next week. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks everyone. This covers obviously the major cybersecurity related events for the week. Thanks for listening. And if you have any topics you would like us to cover, please feel free to contact either Brendan or myself. And until next week, stay safe.